Literacy is dead. At least, that's what a lot of people are saying. We don't think it's true. We do, however, think literacy is about to look different. A lot different. For many people, the words "the end" signify either satisfaction or sorrow. What happens after the end? How do words become catalysts for progress and advancement?
Join us today for The Afterword, a conversation about the future of words. Hi, I'm Amy Boland, literacy specialist, writer, and college instructor.
And I'm Holland Webb, a full-time writer and editor. And this is The Afterword. Last week, Amy and I began talking with Dan and Connie Kazmaier, board game designers for Chai, an immersive tea board game that launched on Kickstarter in 2018, and with James Hannibal, the award-winning author of the Section 13 Mysteries for Kids and a game designer himself. Listen in as we continue that conversation.
And so we're going to recap what we learned last week about basic elements of a game and stories that influence our games.
How can teachers and moms and dads use game design principles to motivate literacy development, whether they're teaching in a school or working in a library, or if they're in a homeschool setting? How can someone who doesn't want to create Chai still take all these ideas and help motivate their kids to move forward through a story? Connie.
So, like I mentioned before, I use games in my classroom all the time, and I bring a lot of the gamification principles into my classroom. So, at the beginning of the year, we actually did like a point system thing. So, every time they would do really well, be encouraging to other people, they get points up, and kids love that. They love hearing that beep that goes off on the computer speakers. Going back to the flow idea, there's something about games that are just, I guess, innate in human nature, and we're just drawn to those, you know, being able to achieve the next level. I guess more specifically to literacy, even Halloween this year, we did some story dice. So we made four of them, and then one of them gives you the character, one of you gives the setting, one is the conflict, and the other is the starting sentence, and the kids would just roll them. And it was a great way to get my super reluctant writers started, because they've kind of, you know, overcome that really difficult first part of writing that first sentence or figuring out some of the main components of the story. And actually, even some of them, after we finished writing our final draft, some of them said, you know what, can I roll it again so I can get another story, because I'm just so excited. And these are kids who hate writing generally, right? So it's amazing using that kind of a just, you know, fun dice kind of rolling mechanism to get kids to be involved. I also use Scrabble pieces in making words kind of curriculum with my kids. So because it's not permanent, it's not like writing it down on a piece of paper, they have a lot more fun. They can kind of substitute letters. And yeah, that's their way of, you know, gaining more literacy skills, but thinking that they're still playing a game. But there are incentives in games. It's active, it's fun, it's not just sitting down with a pen and paper.
Can I ask, did you buy those story cubes or did you make them yourself?
I bought them from other teachers who are doing it. So, but they're both, yeah. And then there's even story cubes I know out there. I bought some, what are they called? I think they're actually just called story cubes, but they're little dice from the store, and they have pictures on them of different, there's a like verbs, like people running or people jumping, and then there's characters as well. So similar idea. The one for Halloween I bought from online, and we printed them out and cut them out and then just made them into cubes.
You know, Connie, and I believe I heard Dan and even James mention this a little bit too, that this concept of breaking down the barriers of entry, I think that's one of the things that games do just tremendously, is breaking down that barrier of entry. James, you told us a little bit about being able to teach writing to middle schoolers, and I'm just wondering how games would help you. And Connie, you're a middle school teacher, so you're kind of like hitting into some similar language here, but James, I'd love to hear what do you use to motivate literacy development in your teaching writing course?
Well, yeah, I'm also a homeschool dad, and so manipulative, like those game dice, like the story dice, story cubes,
are so important. When we, you know, started playing games, talk about the history of games. Will Wright, who created the Sims game, all those Sims games, likes to say that, you know, game play is what became games. We had a rock, just to get the concept out. You've got a rock, you begin playing with the rock, and then there becomes a goal. The goal is to get the rock into a depression. And then you add a friend. How many times can I get the rock into the depression versus how many times can you get the rock into the depression? Suddenly the play with something that is a toy became a game. And that's where we begin to engage our brains the most. And so as it turns out, that's also where we learn the most. So if you're just looking at something on a page or you're looking at something on a PowerPoint presentation and there's no manipulatives involved, you're not going to get the kind of engagement and learning that you want. When I teach creative writing, we work together as a class with different story beats. And so instead of saying start from the beginning and just telling them, you got to create a beginning, a middle, and an end. Well, what does that mean? But mm-hmm. if you break that beginning, middle, and end down into the various story beats and then make a game about coming up with ideas for each story beat and seeing how they all tie together, the call, the refusal, the kick into action, the ordeal, all those little pieces that we find ourselves adding to a story. Let the middle schoolers come up with ideas for each one and then put them together like that puzzle to solve the story itself. And they will remember that, not just for creating their own stories, but for how they read other stories.
Wow, that's interesting. Dan, what have you found? Because I know you're not necessarily in the teaching world per se, but I understand that you really have had a hand in, and I've seen you firsthand in working in a humanitarian setting. So tell me what you've experienced through this motivation and the barriers of entry being broken down as you've observed in the playing of these games.
Yeah, actually, just offhand, I recall when you and your daughter, Connie, and I, and a few others, we were visiting a couple families from Syria, and one of us, maybe it was you actually, you had brought a deck of Uno cards, and immediately the one Syrian girl, her eyes lit up, and she was so excited to play this game, and we quickly realized that the way that they played Uno was slightly different with, you know, the plus two, plus fours, like you add them to other players, and yeah, all these different house rules that kind of take a life of their own when the game goes international. Monopoly would be a classic example of that, or Settlers of Catan. And we quickly discovered that, yeah, we had this wonderful time experiencing this activity that kind of transcended language in a way, from at least a literacy perspective, where the rules were kind of cultural, and even though we couldn't speak the same language, we could still speak the language of game together. So I think from my perspective, that's very rewarding, where you can have a shared experience that isn't necessarily taught. Like, we didn't have to have her learn English to have this experience. And games as kind of an activity, they can bring us out of different troubles or hardships, or at least we can help process those experiences. So at least for me, from a game perspective, one of my dreams is to create some kind of maybe counseling card game or board game that can be used in a humanitarian environment or a classroom that elicits like a good, safe environment where people can express themselves and share.
That's really beautiful. I want to share with you that your vision of seeing a humanitarian need, did you all realize that Candyland, the game Candyland, was invented by a retired school teacher? Her name is Eleanor Abbott, while she was in the hospital recovering from polio. And she was observing all these children who were also recovering from the disease, and they were in pain. And she wanted to help take their kids' minds off their illness. So she created Candyland and sold it back in 1949. So again, I love your dream. I love your vision. And the fact that games do help us break down barriers and cross cultural language issues, and just that dream of supporting and caring for others through gaming is just really, really amazing.
It's interesting that you mentioned Settlers of Catan, Dan. I think that game has been translated into something like 30 languages. I mean, people all around the world really resonate with that concept, no matter what language they speak. It's like you said, the language of games. James, did you have anything you wanted to add there?
No, I think I already said everything I could say on that one.
Okay. Fun from games, I think, really comes out of mastery. And when we talk about literacy education, we talk about any kind of education, mastery is what we're striving for. So let's take an example of teaching a novel unit. How can teachers use the elements of game design to teach a novel unit in order to help their students gain mastery over the novel or in the subject? Connie, I always want to start with Connie for some reason.
I think creating challenges and quests during the novel unit can serve as a way to mark progress, actually, for kids. They like to make learning visible. They like to be able to see how much they've learned, what they've learned, kind of what the objective of the assignment is, because otherwise they don't want to just be doing things to do things, right? So to see, here are the challenges, here are the, our objectives along the way, they can feel like they're improving. I think even in a sense, side quests, borrowing from video games, from some board games, it can be additional bonus work or investigations during the novel unit, so kind of tangents. Something that's really great in games is that quick feedback. So you do an action, and then you see that your army's destroyed by somebody else. In the classroom for a novel unit, it could look like really quick feedback to the students from the teachers or from peers. And here you can mediate with technology to make it a little bit more instant. I think giving voice and choice, so a lot of the draw of games is you're able to decide for yourself, you know, which way are you going to go, which is the most strategic. So for kids, allowing them to best represent their learning through different means and giving them the choice to find one that's engaging for them. I think borrowing from storytelling games like Above and Below, you can kind of see that kids can just, you know, immerse themselves in the world and go off into branches and explore and create stories. And then from there, after they have the story in their head, be able to create literary work from that.
James, would you want to jump into that too?
Well, I think Connie really said it well. And we're talking about giving them the ability to see their mastery, to see achievements. Just like in a game, we want our players to feel a reward as they move up in a more complex game, level per level. That's where we get the idea of experience points and things like that. It's one of the things that really, really draws us to those kinds of games. It's why we see video games being so successful over the last couple of decades. And so why on earth would we see that and then not go through a novel unit and be able to give our students indications of their own mastery, indicate their rewards for each level that they realize. The other part of it is that, especially for boys, just like Connie said, is being involved in the story, being part of the story. So don't just throw at them in this chapter, we see how Jack is showing the reader that danger lies ahead by refusing to leave and head out into the big city or wherever he is in this point of the story. And he lists his reasons. I might get lost. There are those big scary buses, things like that. But instead, ask the kids, okay, if you were writing this story, if you were part of the story and you were in Jack's place, why would you be afraid to leave the hotel? Or what reasons would draw you out there into the city to overcome those reasons? But giving the kids participation in the story helps achieve mastery. It engages new parts of the brain. Mm.
That is awesome. And, you know, I know, James, you had mentioned also before about reader participation. And Connie, you mentioned voice and choice. Dan, I was just wondering if you've experienced maybe some observations and changes in literacy over your involvement with game design.
Yeah, I guess even in the sense of the types of players that come to a game, you're going to find different cultures, different educational backgrounds, different age would be the largest indicator. So a lot of game designers are actually moving towards iconography to make games not only accessible, like we were mentioning before, but language independent in terms of text. So, well, even there's the colorblind friendly movement that's happening. Gamers are roughly 4 to 5% colorblind compared to the general population, which is, I think, 1 to 2. So making sure that there's not a lot of green or red that are clashing quite a bit, because for a lot of players, they're going to see largely the same shade. Illiteracy takes a whole different kind of form when designing a game. Even the product design itself, and making sure that, like, everything can fit in the box and everything is easily accessible. So I guess I'm trying to describe something that's not as tangible, but when you open a box and you're not sure how things work, or a part of a game that you're familiar with because of a different game, for example, if you had little houses in Settlers of Catan and a different game had the same piece, you would assume different information upon that and how it functions. But that might not be translatable into this other game that uses that piece. So if you're trying to understand people's expectations when they open up your game and how they will read your game in a way, just by looking at the pieces or the rule book, and the, let alone trying to understand how it plays. So just from a design perspective, there's different ways of approaching this altogether.
That is fascinating because, you know, Dan, we talk about that there are different literacies, that we have disciplinary literacies. So you have literacy in social studies, literacy in science, literacy in math. You read those things differently than you would reading Basel or some type of magazine. And so what I'm hearing you say is that even within gaming and board games, there is a literacy, and how to read that game really depends on the design and maybe your background knowledge, some experience. And what I'm hearing you say, and you've introduced me to a brand new word, iconography. Am I saying it correctly?
Yes.
Fascinating. Language-free games.
That's right. Specific terms as well. So a word we would use is orthogonally, which means diagonal and horizontal. So your piece can move either to the left or the right or above and below. But gamers would use the word orthogonally.
And you sound like a chess master.
Actually, you brought up two interesting trends in that answer. One is diversity in games, and I'd be very interested in hearing all of you address that, actually. Are games becoming more diverse, and if so, how? And then the other is just something as simple as 3D printing and how that's allowing individual game designers to be able to create something that's sort of boutique and actually sell it without having to wait for a large company to want their game and buy it and mass produce it in order to have the little miniatures that go with it. But speaking first to diversity, James, can you speak to that at all?
Well, you know, this is a trend on a number of segments of creative arts, and especially in writing as well. And what we talk about is creating both mirrors and windows. I don't just want to create a mirror that one type of child can look into when I'm creating books for youth. One type of child can look into this book and see a mirror of themselves and see themselves as part of the story. I also want to create a window so that child can look into this book and see themselves as part of someone else's story, someone else's experience, who's from a different segment of society. That way, we help them identify with each other. Games are the same. We need to be cognizant of that as we're creating games, that we're not creating games that are simply a mirror of our own kind and our own type of experience. The fantasy gaming industry lends itself a great deal to that and is sort of has a leg up and is far ahead because you're creating a completely different world. And so many, many people from many different walks can access that world more comfortably, but you still have to be cognizant of it.
Hmm. That's brilliant.
Connie, did you want to say anything about diversity?
Yeah. So we had actually over 20 countries playtest our game in the development process. And actually very early on, some of the playtesters with our earlier art said, you know, all these, they look like white people. So where's my people? Right? And it was really interesting because to us, that was something we were going for, that, you know, having diverse people in our game, diverse experiences of the world, of tea in our games, but it was like the first thing our playtesters noticed. And so now that we have our new art, which we have, you know, a Moroccan tea person in the desert drinking Moroccan mint tea, we've got a tea walla in India, we've got kind of North American representations of tea. It celebrates that diversity, and I think people really get that and they appreciate that in a game. I think as countries in the world talk to each other more, I think board games need to evolve with that and also celebrate all those experiences around the world.
And Dan, that kind of pulls right into your heart and desire to share this dream game, which it sounds like you're pretty close to creating that, that brings in just conversation and people together. You want to add anything else to that?
Sure. Yeah, we have an expression sometimes in the game community where we say you're welcome at my table, my board game table, but that's also like your kitchen table where you have food and tea, coffee, whatever kind of beverages. And as we talk about accessibility, not only for colorblind or people of different educational or cultural backgrounds, that also goes into race or other barriers that sometimes get in the way of true community. So yeah, that's just been a really important value for us. And we're glad that that's definitely a priority in the game world. People sometimes say that games or anime, video games, comic books, all of these creative ways of expressing humanity, they're kind of safe harbors for people of different backgrounds to come and, you know, just have fun together. So, yeah, we really want to keep pushing that. And we even see our little game as hopefully helping in that regard, because it's not normally a theme you would think of having tea and games together. So, yeah, we're looking for other ways that that can kind of expand too. And hopefully our future designs will reflect that.
That is beautiful. I love that little catchphrase, you are welcome at my table. James, I'm hearing kind of the similar thing as you have become very inclusive in this reader participation with your new venture that you're working on. And this is just amazing. I think we'd like to give you all just a few minutes as we close up our podcast today and give you an opportunity to maybe share about your dream game or what's going on in your world. We'd love you to have an opportunity to share with our listeners just what's going on in your world of games. We want to welcome you to our table tonight. And let's start off with James.
You know, you get the chance to design a game, and, you know, you're going to go for your dream game, right? So, you know, we started with a small game, Starlots, that we're Kickstartering down the road here in quarter two. And that's a simpler thing to get things running. But what we're working on as a background is a situational learning game that is something between that board game, that traditional board game, and that role-playing game. Because not everybody has the opportunity to sit down for several hours on Saturdays to play that really in-depth role-playing game. But there's so many cool things that you can get out of taking part in a story like that. So we're trying to find the balance in something called Migrator Quest. And here's the really cool thing. I'm not developing that game. I'm sort of the supervisor, which is great. But the guy that is really in charge of this came over to us from previously working on the One Ring Lord of the Rings games. And so his brain is just incredible. And he's developing my dream game, and I'm just sort of watching it happen. And I'm just super excited about it.
That's awesome. How about you, Dan?
I guess we're going to keep chying away on chai. expansion called Bubble Tea, hopefully this year. We're just trying to figure out the full distribution network. And, you know, we'd love to be in a Target or a Walmart down the road. But beyond that, we just enjoy talking about, you know, our vision for games. And it's very active here in Calgary. We're going to probably 7 or 8 conventions this year internationally. And it's really neat because we say that you're welcome at our table, but we have so many homes that, you know, are welcoming us. If we, for example, we were in Thailand last summer, and some playtesters greeted us there in a place that we were vacationing in. So just those really awesome opportunities to connect with people. And, yeah, maybe next year we also have a submarine game or a civilization-type game for family as well. But we'll just keep being open to things like that humanitarian trauma counseling game. We're, yeah, just trying to figure life out too.
All right. Well, that sounds wonderful. How about you, Connie?
I think I'm just really excited that we've wrapped up the prototype place of Chai, and our house was filled with boxes, reviewer copies for probably about 2 or 3 months. So it's nice to have most of that out. We just wrapped up our Kickstarter 2 weeks ago, I think. So that was actually also pretty intense period where we were working probably, I would say, 18 hours a day and getting very little sleep. So, yeah, just very excited that we're going into kind of a pre-order season, which is slower, getting all those boxes out. We do have a 3D printer, going back to Holland's earlier question. Now, because we have a 3D printer making prototypes where, you know, we could probably use this in our future games, printing some miniatures or some more prototypes in the future.
Just enjoying the journey.
Lest we think that games are just for fun, I wanted to share this little bit before we close out. Elizabeth Magee, who was a very early social justice advocate, originally designed the game of Monopoly to explain how landlords were taking advantage of their renters. It's changed a little over the years, but the game of Monopoly was also a lifesaver during World War II when the Nazi army allowed the British government to send games to their prisoners of war soldiers. And with cooperation from the game's publisher, the British government hid real money in the stack of Monopoly money, as well as compasses, files, and a folded silk map. And the British soldiers used those supplies to flee their POW camp. So games matter in a lot of ways. They can even save your life. If anyone wants to get in touch with you, James, how can they do that?
Right now, the best way to get in touch with me is either through the James R. Hannibal Facebook page or go to theministryexpress.com, or they can go to lightraiders.com, since we have one for the book series and one for the games.
Okay. And what about you, Dan and Connie? How can people get in touch with you?
Yeah, they can reach out through chaiboardgame.com or track us down on Facebook or Twitter, and we're happy to answer any personal messages.
Thank you so much. So what's the takeaway, Amy?
Well, you know, what we talked about tonight is that games challenge players to achieve mastery. Tonight, we heard that people need mirrors and windows. We heard about diversity. We heard barriers of entry. We heard that we need problem and solution. Mastery in all these things is what we want when we teach anyone, whether it's children to read, adults. And what we learned tonight was, how can we overlap between games and literacy to produce a class in mastery, whatever it may be in life. And so we're just really grateful to Dan and Connie Casimir and to
James Hannibal.
And this is
The Afterword. Next week, we have a whole new topic on the future of words. We'll be talking about how disability is portrayed in literary works and how authors present a positive or negative message of inclusion and acceptance toward people with disabilities. To talk about that, we've invited Dr. Julia Wilkins, a professor at Presbyterian College, Lucy Plyler, a social worker for the Division of Services for the Blind, and Hartley Plyler, an entrepreneur with Davis Donuts. Join us wherever you're listening now or on our website, theafterwardpodcast.com.